Hi, welcome to Pat's Labor, the labor podcast about labor and the podcast Labor. Pod Labor Pat. Pod Labor Pat Labor Pat. Very heavy rotation, Darrison.
Welcome. My name is Susan Egan.
My name is Clayton Ashton.
And I'm Patrick. Welcome to the show. How's everybody doing?
Going great. Doing great.
Doing good. Had a nice time watching this movie last night. I hope it's still fresh in your mind as it is for me.
Absolutely.
Because it's fucking rules.
It's so good. It's so good. And it's like, I like, not to jump like too much into it, but like I had seen this for the first time years ago because I was seeing it in perspective to like Mamoru Oshii's other films at that time. I was writing about it, and I had never watched the Pat Labor anime. I only seen the Pat Labor movies, and it's just so fascinating to rewatch this because I already enjoyed this film, but now I enjoy it not just as a Mamoru Oshii fan, but as a principal Pat Labor fan. And I notice things about this series and about this movie that it does respective to the OVA that I just love. It makes so much sense that like this works both as a standalone film and as a continuation of the OVA. Yeah.
So today we are talking about the Pat Labor movie, which is called Pat Labor. The movie came out in 1989.
Wait, you guys didn't watch episode 8?
No. Nope. Didn't watch never. There is no episode 8.
This is kind of
on the topic of episode 8.
Yeah.
Yes, I was going to say, is this it? Because I'm confused about one very specific thing.
Mm.
Where does this take place in the timeline? Because the dub I watched for my refresh, so I've seen this originally a while ago, and then I watched a hilariously bad Canadian dub of it earlier today.
Incredible.
And the scene where they meet Nagumo on the arc is written as if they're meeting for the first time. And I don't remember if it's that way in the original sub that I watched.
I didn't get that vibe.
Okay.
I think they'd already met them, but they were just like, it's she's just off doing like section one stuff. And they're just like, we're just going to find an excuse to come to the arc to see this like cool new labor. I'm guessing that was
a liberty that the localizers took for the dub that I watched.
Yes.
For people who are like, they're going to have no idea who this woman getting out of this mech is. So let's like have her introduce herself.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, so this appears to take place after the events of the main series because the sort of central civic project that motivated the creation of the labors themselves
is reaching a very
important milestone.
That thing about the Babylon Project.
Yeah.
The fact that this is a lot about how that is wrapping up and how that's going to change things.
Yeah. It's them talking to each other. These characters know each other, but they are sort of informally introducing each other to each other for the sake of the audience who has not already been there. It's like, oh, hey, Azuma, how you doing? Oh, hey, Noah, it's going great. Like this kind of dynamic. One of the things that immediately leapt out to me upon rewatching this is like, you know, at the beginning of each of the OVA episodes, like you'd have like the opening where they go like labors and like the creation of the labors. And it's all about the Babylon Project and stuff like that. They would always have like this sort of like pan out where they show like a labor and like there's all these police that are around it. It was like labor crime and all that stuff. And the way that the film's solution to that, their analog to that, is this helicopter pilot who is flying Azuma and Noah to like the Ark, which is part of the Babylon Project, and him sort of extemporaneously like talking about the Babylon Project and about how we would have never made this in time were it not for labors. But then there's things like labor crime, and that's where you guys come in, and they're just sort of like half asleep.
Yeah.
I'm just like, yeah, like this isn't for people who have already watched the OVA. This is for people who have not watched the OVA, who just wandered into the theater today, so they understand what the whole premise is.
That's
really
the impact of the gag of them being asleep for it
yes.
is when I think of it in that framing, it's really funny that, like, in that moment, they're the stand-in for us who have just watched the OVA and fucking know all of this stuff.
And it's so funny to be on either side of that, like, first having watched this, not watched Pat Labor, and being that guy who didn't get the joke, and now having watched the OVA and not getting the joke now. Like, I really love that, yeah.
The thing is start at the beginning of the movie, because that's like after the title drop.
That's after the title drop. Yes, that's true.
And boy, does this, like, I'm thinking about the people who wandered in and were just like expecting mecha action, because you do get that right off the bat here.
Oh, yeah.
And a little bit of a difference, a little bit high budget for this movie. I guess technically, the very first thing is this sort of, I don't know how to describe other than a little avant-garde couple of shots of Tokyo Bay and a man jumps to his death.
Yeah,
he's smiling, he has a big chin.
Yeah, he's got a bird, and people are reaching out to be like, no, and then he's just like jumps off of a beam, and then it just pans down to the ocean, and then it opens on some jungle battlefield. There's some type of fighting exercise going on, like mechs are being dropped out of like cargo helicopters. It was really fucking cool.
The cut from just like the black of the sea to like the black night sky, and then the laborers coming down, and they're only lit by their own thrusters as they
break
to sort of like break before they hit the ground. And yeah, this scene is interesting because I think this is like the first time within the Pat Labor series we have seen like deployed full military labors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like this is what war would be like with laborers.
Yeah.
But it's also, I mean, for the movie's purposes, this is like intercut with credits at this point. And the music starts kind of pounding. It's sick. I mean, it's just really cool. And I kept thinking, okay, these things, first of all, they're the paratroopers, which we know that was kind of what we ended on, or the sixth episode was about like prototype paratrooper labors. So it's interesting to me that it seems like now they're perfected. Maybe that was to me another clue of the chronology of this. But they got Zaku eyes. I mean,
yeah,
they're being dropped out of big airplanes. They're leaning a little bit more than they typically do. I mean, we also have a giant robot weapons platform with a little robot head, which is also kind of a Gundam thing. But I also took note here that we have a Japanese flag on these, I think, on the planes, you notice first. So then you're at least getting like grounded a little bit. Okay, where is this? Well, I know this army is of Japan, and there is a big red tank mecha platform that they are fighting.
Yeah.
Yes. And the sequence is really cool. It almost plays out like a hunt, kind of, because at first you're a little confused as to whether these are opposing forces, like setting up their gear in the battlefield, and then it's like, no, they're all after this one particular red tank. Like, they're sending choppers after it, and it's just like ducking and dodging and weaving, and it's a crazy looking design, but it is a very cool looking labor. And the Type X-10, I wrote that down too because it's a cool name. But yeah, it's stalking and ducking and weaving through the jungle, through the deep forest, and then eventually it gets caught in an ambush. It gets all tangled up in wires, and then they go predator on it. They do the entire rescue squad unloading into the jungle shot on it, but they're hitting it over and over and over and over.
It works here. It's a pretty big target.
Yeah.
But then, as the day breaks and they pry the thing open on top to see who did this, they find out the cockpit was empty.
Ooh. Bum,
bum, bum. Or I guess that out. They seemingly knew that. We'll find out later, but.
Right.
I want to issue a quick, because I think it's sort of poignant, but it's not daybreak. That it looks like daybreak. It looks like a transition to daybreak because the lighting on the craft changes. Then we get the shot of the bottom of a helicopter that has such a powerful light on it that it can make night look like day. And it's just like, that's a very subtle thing, but it's also so cool just to, in this world where these machines have become so powerful that here is a helicopter is going to fly over and it is going to make it look like daylight.
Because also implies they were on it quick. They're trying to destroy this thing and pry it open, and who's in there? No one.
No.
Nobody.
One.
Title card.
Yeah.
Awesome card. Music. It's great.
There was like a moment of, oh yeah, these aren't drones for me there, which is like, just like, it's got to be tough to make a show in the giant robot space when there is an inherent confusion about whether or not what the difference between mecha and robot is. So
yeah.
Like, and also I think it's just that like the idea of rogue military drones have become such sort of a trope at this point that like the reveal that there's not somebody in there is less of a reveal to me.
So, oh my God.
Like, I kind of just figured this was an unmanned
piloted
craft.
Machine that's able to like fire on people. That's crazy. Yeah. I'm just like, yeah, I know. Isn't it?
There's some other stuff in this that did make me think, oh, this is weirdly contemporary. But this part of it, to me, I was fully on board for its surprise because for Pat Labor, this does seem unusual.
Yes.
We've never really encountered a robot, especially this size, that is running autonomously.
Right. And that is important to the lore and to the story that happens here. But yeah, what an opening. This movie rips.
Oh, yeah. So good.
Okay, so then we catch up. Nagumo is on the Ark, and specifically, she is in a labor we haven't seen before, the Type Zero.
The Type Zero.
And it's, I mean, okay, she's testing it, and the pair of chuckleheads, they're here to escort her back to base.
Asuma and Noah are here to escort her back. Our beloved chuckleheads are back.
Yeah. But what is it? I think it's Noah says, don't you think he looks like a bad guy, referring to this Type Zero? And it's like, yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Foreshadowing, perhaps, perchance.
She has an Are We the Baddies moment. And it's funny because, I mean, that like, they it is like, again, it is the show sort of brushing up against the advancing militarization of these tools, like even the ones that are, you know, initially built to resemble big police officers kind of, are now starting to look more sinister and more streamlined and more dangerous. And this is right after we saw a scene where one of them that is a pure weapon was just going completely rogue in the countryside.
Mm. And then we get our next kind of like setup for the movie, a major plot point, which is that this labor is not just scary looking. It's also the first labor to be built from the ground up based on Hoss.
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 I laughed immediately when I heard them say that. I'm like,
a big Hoss.
We got a big Hoss in this one.
Yeah, we do.
I got a Hemi in it. Yeah. So they're rebuilding all of the labors with a Hemi. No, they have Hoss, which is hyper operating system.
Hyper operating system.
Which, you know what? Sick. I love that. I love it's just called the hyper operating system.
It was the 80s, man.
What do you think the HOS does?
The HOS? It optimizes all the software for like old labors. It makes them more efficient, I guess. It's like some type of like quantum leap in like operating systems that was invented by Shinohara Heavy Industries.
Sure.
Yes. This is also interesting here that this is the labor corporation we know because it's Asuma's dad's.
Yeah.
But the thing I was thinking, like, in addition to this movie coalescing a lot of this series' thoughts about militarization, but also it feels like the not the consumerism, but the fact that labors are a product.
Yeah.
And so, like, part of the reason they need to make them for military is like, well, we need another market because we're the biggest market for labors is about to dry up. So we got to export these things. And hyper operating system, it was a 30% improvement on labor efficiency. So it was about, like, we didn't, like, you're pointing this out, we didn't get the specifics of what it did other than it made them a better value because they could do more work.
Right.
Right.
I thought that was kind of interesting too.
And speaking of the military stuff, there is an incredible reveal later in the film. That's just an offhand thing that doesn't matter much, but about the origins of Shinohara Heavy Industries, which we will come back to when we get to that point.
Oh, yes.
Which made a lot of things feel very full circle about the series.
Yep.
But yes, so the Babylon Project has reclaimed nearly 40,000 hectares of new land. The labors have been completely essential in the process of reclaiming land that's been lost to rising sea levels and climate change in Japan. But now we are menaced by the possibility that these Thangs are going rogue. And so that is part of why Nagumo has been called back, is to help with the effort to keep an eye on things.
It's also a personal favor.
Yeah, that's true.
It's Kanuka, we find out, just a little catch up on where is everybody. Kanuka's back in New York City.
Yep.
That's right.
In the NYPD experimental labor force, which is a little funny to me that they would call it that. But she's getting three of these Type Zeros next, and she's like, I want to know that they work, and I trust you, Nagumo, basically, to test them out for me. And we get this kind of catch up with the rest of SV-1, which is that SV-1 is also going to get them. So that's Nagumo also is kind of interested in them for that reason. And her team is training for those new Type Zeros, which means everything is on SV-2 right now.
Yes.
First, they got passed up for like the new Pat Labors in the actual OVA, and then they finally get these Type Zeros. But because they're busy like training for that, now like SV-2 is now back on the shit list, and they have to like fill in for everything. Every single time, they always have to fill in for SV-1. Where is SV-1? What are they doing?
Like, it's a pretty good joke that they're like, once again, they're busy. Like, yeah. Sorry, they're off camera.
Yeah.
So yeah, they're basically told, and by the way, the training's going to take another week, so y'all got another week of work. Sorry.
Yeah, I believe around this time is when we get our next bit of robot action, which is uncommon for Pat Labor, because we have a rogue piece of construction equipment. And this is a comedic scene because we've got sort of a pairing of course, Oda, who is our hot-headed, shoot first, getting a lot of troubles. a lot of trouble later character, and the pilot of the rogue construction mech, who is still inside the cockpit while it's happening.
We get a little bit of kind of important foreshadowing too, is that they're waiting in station, and it's kind of cool, we've never seen this before, but they're waiting in station, they just got the news. I think Asuma says, "This sucks. Who's going to safeguard our rights?" And then Oda says, "In the Force, you have none."
Yeah. And just like, this is really putting a strain on my marriage. That's your fault for getting married. Yeah. I'm just like, dude.
But then an alarm goes off. And that's the thing we've never seen. Almost like a fire department style, like a 205 in progress. And they mention, gosh, these have been happening so much more lately.
Yeah.
Yeah, the scene of the robot rampaging is a lot of fun, though. He's like crashing through what looks like a sort of a suburb or like a residential neighborhood of Tokyo.
And that's steps all those, on a like, cop car.
Yeah, all these corrugated tin roofs, and this really great shot of just a cat up on a roof, just looking at this robot sort of
in the
like
distance, yeah,
tromping along in the horizon. But yeah, they send the Pat Labor out.
They send this Pat Labor out. We get the kind of cool like raising it up. All the people are like impressed by it. And then Oda walks up and finds the cop, and he's like, "That guy smashed my car. I want revenge." And Oda's like, "I got it," and immediately steps back on the cop's car too.
Yeah.
But yeah, Oda does a really bad job stopping the mech. He's like getting dragged behind it, and there's this incredible helicopter shot of him just sort of like hugging this big orange like construction mech from behind, and it's just dragging him through a neighborhood, like ripping down power lines and like knocking buildings over.
My favorite part is where he announces himself and he's part of SV-2, and then like you see the visible change on the mech operator's face, like the construction mech operator's face, and he's like, "Not Section 2. What did I do to deserve this?" I'm like, "Oh my god, this like these dumbasses have a reputation where it's just like, oh, I'm not going home tonight."
it's not a good reputation.
It's not working out for me right now. Like, oh god, it's like that.
But
sucks.
They are able to team up the two police patrol labors and pull the cockpit piece off of the rogue vehicle so that the guy's at least safe. And then the brawl like tumbles into the river, which also looks fucking badass.
Mm-hmm.
It looks really great, and then they I think technically before that, a little important thing is they stun it, like with a stun prod, and that, like that's the guy safe, they deactivated it, okay, you know, mission accomplished, oh, let's go home before another one of these happens, but before they can, it reactivates.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of creepy even how it does, and then the fight continues, and that's where I think it gets shoved into the water, and then Oda finally like finishes it by I noted he shoots six times and I think one or maybe two hit it, and he's like effectively Pat Labor point blank range, like yeah. which is probably 20 feet, but still it's like, come on, how did you miss?
Okay, I've got it right here. He misses with every shot except for the last, which then hits the like some sort of CO2 tank or something.
Is that what? Okay, it wasn't the bullets that did that.
Yeah.
No. The one shot he hits some sort of like liquid ice stuff that leaks out of the robot and then freezes him solid. And the last shot that we have of him is a sort of gag shot of him just kind of turned into a popsicle.
Excellent scene.
So much money wasted. So much money wasted.
Those are your six bullets for the year, Oda.
Right, for the year.
Okay, so back at station, we get another important update on this. Already, we've had 22 of these crazy labor incidents this month, and they all started picking up about 3 months ago. And they connect it fairly obviously here to the new plot line here, which is Haas. Because Haas also came online or started getting distributed 3 months ago. You can connect the dots there pretty easily. So easily, in fact, that Godo's like,
Yes.
We can't bring this up because the powers be do not want people thinking that programs are running amok. In fact, that can't happen. It is impossible. It is not possible for a labor to reactivate itself. These must be human error.
Mm-hmm.
And then we kind of realize later that he is intentionally hamming this. He's laying it on thick. He's making it like, and I like this because I didn't realize it in the as it was happening. And then it's like, oh, afterwards, of course. Because why else would Asuma get into something so seriously, so dedicated with such dedication? It was, you know, to flip the finger at the big guys at the top.
He needs some pushback in order to like really have incentive to go after something. And I love that he asks the main mechanic guy if he can have access to like the computer room. And like, he's like, what, you want access to the computer room? He looks over to Goda and Goda just like gives like a hand signal. And he's like, permission granted. Where it's just like, yeah, it's really Goda who is goading Asuma to actually go on and do this stuff. Like, yeah. I love that. Yeah.
And he also makes a call.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He makes a call.
To our old friends.
Who it is.
Yeah, it's the inspector.
I wrote him down as Detective Sea Monster.
Detective Sea Monster. He's back. He's back, baby.
Do you have a mystery that vaguely involves Tokyo Bay?
It's like, I'm the guy. Do you need somebody to walk around like these old shanty towns in a montage and just like hunt down like different sorts of like clues and stuff? He's your guy. Like, yeah, I love those scenes, by the way.
They're so good. There's just music. You don't get audio from where he is. It's just kind of a montage.
Yeah.
Rundown houses that all seem to have a birdcage in them.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
but not much yet that we're kind of figuring out what's going on here.
They're sort of stalking around these less, not yet like redeveloped parts of Tokyo, and finding little clues to what might be going on. But we don't really have the full picture yet. We have a tiny piece of the picture. But Shinohara's research is fruitful because he finds. Or he gets to the point where he theorizes that there must be something wrong with the update. And he once again shows up in Goda's office to make his case, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And there is just more hilarious Goda manipulation in this scene. Because his initial reaction is like, well, if there is an error, we can't go to the menu. What Shinohara wants to do is go to Shinohara Heavy Industries and demand to see the code and demand to check their code to see if the error is their fault. Godo's resistance to that is this really like cowardly thing for a second, right? He's like, we can't do that because like that, you know, we're going to shut this poor company down if we do that. And we can't have them panicking.
He doesn't give a shit. I just love how he's able to play devil's advocate with such a straight face that you can't detect it up to a certain point where it's just like, no, this is – no, he's putting one over on me. He's putting one over on Asuma. It's like just to like – probe him to continue doing stuff. This, like, because he's really just laying it out and just like, look, this has to be airtight. I am giving you every single obstacle before you actually meet it, so that when we actually do have our case, that we're able to like bring it and like nobody can refute it. Or if they do refute it, then they're just absolutely corrupt. Like, we just have to like make that clear. Yeah.
And he also turns the pressure up on him even more by saying, and also, we just put this new OS on all of our patrol labor. So, geez, people would flip out if they found out about that.
Yeah, that would be bad, wouldn't it?
I feel like there was also, he was like, we can't be mean to Shinohara Heavy Industries. We can't, you know, it'd be such a shame if Shinohara was to get all mad about this, what us messing with them, you know. And you can tell he knows that the relationship with his dad is not great. And that's something he can also kind of lean. So he's like tweaking him from various ways because a part of me was at times I was like, man, Asuma is like trying so hard, and he's actually being much more in some way straight-laced detective in this episode than he usually is. And he's, you know, maybe he's matured, but actually it's also that Gota just knows how to manipulate him so well at this point.
And this is entirely personal for him. But the animation and the body language in this scene where Gota is sort of manipulating Azuma into doing detective work is so funny, because Goto's like sitting at his desk and he's got a pile of papers, no joke, probably 10 inches tall sitting in front of him. He's just sort of like sheepishly pushing it around, pushing the top paper around and be like, no, we really can't go and bother Shinohara Industries. It's great stuff.
Yeah.
So he decides to go bother Shinohara Industries.
Yeah. And how did he figure this out about Hoba?
Hoba.
I believe this is like the first leads have come back from the investigators. But I could I could be wrong here. But they learned that, yes, there was a staff member on staff at Shinohara Industries, a programmer, goes by the name Ihoba, who disappeared around the time that all this stuff started. And he has testimony from some people that he's dead. So that's the beginning of the film.
The mastermind behind Hoss.
Yes, and he was, specifically.
He's the big Hoss. He's the big Hoss. Single-handedly wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
Also, he went to MIT, but a weird thing is that all the records from his employment and his college time at MIT are gone. They've been scrubbed.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to him just kind of like disappearing off the face of the earth, with all his records gone about the time that Hoss came out, 5 days ago, he fell from the Babylon Project. Or maybe it was the Ark, but he's seemingly dead. They did note, though, no body was recovered.
So he might... Yeah, so it's a situation where it's like, is this guy secretly pulling the strings from somewhere, making these robots go crazy? Or is it something else altogether?
Is it something he's done? Who knows?
Yeah. Oh. Then we have the scene that I wanted to talk about, which is the old engineer guy. I forget his name every time, but the old engineer who does crew maintenance for the SV2 says, I got to go talk to an old friend at Shinohara Industry. I promise this won't interfere with your investigation. Again, and I think this might be part of the overall bait to get Izuma into the building, because he's like, oh, let me come along.
Old man Sakaki.
I do have to note, I guess something just for like behind the scenes, all the voice actors are different. I think all of them.
Yeah. Because I know that one character comes back towards the end and I realized, wait, they sound a lot different than I remember them sounding in the OVA.
Well, it was Sakaki that I was like, whoa, that's a different voice. Everybody else's was close enough to the OVA that I was like, it didn't like bother me. It was, and they were fine voice actors. but his voice was quite different and threw me for a loop at first.
But he has an old friend who still works at Shinohara Industries, and they have this brief scene where they're sort of talking shop about what it's been like watching the advancement of this technology over their lifespans. And Sakaki says something along the lines of, like, you know, like a good man makes a good machine. Yeah, they're espousing their philosophies on how machines should be used.
And he doesn't understand much about all these newfangled OSs. He's about the machinery. Yeah.
Right. And then we get the reveal from his friend who offhandedly mentions that the way Shinohara Industries started was making truck parts for the occupation forces after World War II. So we've talked a whole lot over this about little elements of this sort of future vision of Japanese society that are, you know, direct, that could have been influenced by the sort of occupation era. And so then it is funny to see a direct link where it's like, not only is it influenced by this entire heavy industry is a direct outgrowth of them supporting the U.S. occupation of their own territory after the Second World War.
Yeah, could not be a clearer, brighter line connection to what we've been talking
could
about
be
this whole
time.
More
explicit, yeah. I love that.
Which is great, because it also makes so much sense. It, I mean, like, you wouldn't be shocking if they had other companies that also similarly were big industrial companies that got started in some way connected to that, and also right. The, like, how Japan's economy was set up and somewhat directed by that occupation at first.
While this is going on, our boy is doing some snooping.
I did like that at the end of that conversation, that Sakaki just asks, "Is Hoss kosher?"
it's good to ask if something is kosher in the movie that also contains references to Jehovah and the Ark and Babylon.
That's another thing, like the
Old Testament stuff.
You're right. It's another one of those Old Testament metaphors in this episode. This movie.
The reason why there's so many like Christian like references and like names and stuff like that in this is because I think in this era, like, Oshi was just like really fascinated with weaving Christian sort of symbolism into his work, and he was just so hung up on the fact that Noah's name sounded like Noah's Ark that he just started like naming things after that. I'm just like, why would you name this major industrial municipal like project after what is in no uncertain terms a biblical apocalyptic event that then results in the shattering of humanity across the entire expanse of the earth. Like this is literally the prototypical like story of hubris, of biblical hubris. Like what are you doing?
I think a lot about that movie, Sunshine, the Danny Boyle movie, that they named not one, but two spaceships to go to the sun.
Icarus? Did they call them Icarus?
Sorry,
Icarus. Why would you name it Icarus? Why would
not
you just
once,
name
but twice.
Why don't you just name it Daedalus?
Call it
Daedalus didn't die.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
There is a bit of a vibe there, but I suppose... Is that different from Hideki Anno also doing that? Was his also just like a vibe?
I think it was a vibe, and it was also for the fact of like
that has some more direct, I guess, story allegories.
Yes,
well, I would
but
say this it, does but, too. But go ahead.
It's more for the fact that the Evangelion Christian mythology stuff was also rooted in the fact that, and I'm going to throw you for a loop here. Ava was inspired by Ultraman and Suabari Productions. And I don't know if you know about founder of Suabara became a Catholic later on in life. And then he started weaving that stuff into Ultraman. And then like a whole bunch of kids who grew up watching Ultraman and seeing like Ultraman being mounted on a cross on a hillside and thinking, oh, that's cool. That's an Ultraman reference, and they just put it in Ultraman. I'm just like, it's just like, you know what I mean? It's
Trad-Cath Ultraman.
It's both It's both deeper and not as deep as you think it is. It's deep for different reasons. Yeah.
I mean, it's like, you know, like I have to imagine that maybe there is like when we're making fiction and stuff over here and we are looking for ways to sort of spice up our narratives. Like it is extremely common, right? To like look to, Japanese mythology or Chinese mythology or ancient Greek mythology or Norse mythology and stuff.
Gilgamesh and that sort of thing. Yeah.
Right.
Gilgamesh. Yeah. 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 And it's like, we don't own that stuff. And we don't like a lot of, it doesn't line up with a lot of our like theological systems or whatever, but it's really cool. And it's a cool space to explore and play.
It just sounds cool. From. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that happens the other way too, right? Like, yeah. I mean, it clearly happens the other way, the amount of like.
But when you have them happen in such close proximity to one another, you're like, what's going on here? It's like, nah, it just sounds cool. It just sounds cool.
But here, okay, the next scene is actually one of these connections that does make sense in a way where Shinohara, he gets into the room he's not supposed to be in and finds what he's looking for, which is the original Haas disc.
Mm-hmm.
And he throws it into the machine and he's trying to figure out, I guess, hack in, get the information they're looking for. And he discovers it's like encrypted, password protected. And I think just trying to get into it trips off its like virus attack mode.
Yeah. Ehoba. Oh, that's kind of like Jehovah.
Young Hove.
And then what word like starts spamming on every single computer screen in the factory?
Babble, 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 babble.
And we get what I think is you've said the fisheye is his trademark here, but I think there's a specific thing where it's when computers are almost like looking at people.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's almost like from this perspective of the computer, it's a different kind of creature, and it's what it sees is different from. But here, when this is happening, and he's kind of just like dumbstruck at what's going on, we get one of those classic fisheye, shots.
There's another one that happens, but it's not through the prism of technology, but it's just more. It's used for comedic effect. For comedic effect. We'll get to there. We'll get to that. Yeah.
And so, you know, errors are spreading throughout the entire factory. It's chaos, and they just try to get out of there real fast.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We get some more cool vignettes of our detectives walking around old bits of Tokyo. I forget.
Scaling down into canals and just, like, going through stuff and asking questions. And, like, it's really, really
cool. A lot of junkyards, too, now. And, like, not even buildings as much as just, like, rubble, which is interesting. And
I think this is the first scene where we do get a bit of a hint of something that's happening, which is we see a couple of new high-rise buildings from the old neighborhood, and we hear the wind sort of whistling through them.
Yeah.
We see, because he's, from every one of these buildings, they can see, from every one of the run-down, dilapidated places the detectives are going to, they can see these same skyscrapers. You get the same perspective. And you also get some information because he delivers this like another update to Gota, and he's like, Hoba moved to 26 different places. And every time he moved, he left behind the like change of address, and that's it. That's like the only record that's out there. All his other information deleted. So clearly he's like leaving a trail.
And what was it? Like he moved 26 times or so in the span of like, how long was it?
I think
like,
that 3 months, like once the software came out to where he committed suicide seemingly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He moved 26 times, and they start to note like because the like literally it's actually a great scene where they're like in a room, they're kind of talking and looking. I think you get the whistling skyscraper town, and then after they like talked for a sec, a construction worker pokes his head in and is like, are you guys done? Can we get going? They're literally tearing down that building, and they start talking about, you know, it's interesting, all these places he bought were like he stayed at were just about to get torn down, or they were so dilapidated no one cared about them, so they inevitably would. And so he's kind of leaving, but if there was any evidence there, like that's been wiped away or will be soon. And it's like, is that is that what he's doing, or is he trying to tell us something else? Like, what is he's trying to communicate something clearly, but what is it?
I was gonna say, and then Noah and Azuma eat a JPEG of a pizza.
Well, okay, I think there was something here. Because I want to get to the pizza.
Yes.
It looked so good, and I was a little hungry watching this movie. But we also get Gota backstory.
Yes, which is like, we do.
Little morsel. We get so little of them. He was known as Godo the Razor.
Godo the Razor. Yeah.
And maybe this time he was just too damn sharp.
Yeah, why is he on this reclaimed land? And it's like, well, he was just a little too sharp. He was a little too formidable for his own good. So they put him.
Yeah, so that was his nickname.
Yeah.
At the police like headquarters, what people thought of him. He was known as Godo the Razor. But why did he go to this kind of like Podunk, the bad team of the two Pat Labor divisions.
Yeah.
Like it's still a conundrum. We know a little bit more about it. Yes, obviously everybody else knows he's goaded too, but like why is he there?
And it makes you like reflect back on the OVA two-part episode when the JSDF, like this rogue faction of the JSDF, tries to mount a coup, and like the turns out the leader is like an old comrade of Godo, and he's like, he knew that only Godo would be the one to like be able to like put all the pieces together about what was going on. And so even that sort of relationship of that is just like, I think that he does not lack for respect when it comes to his peers, but I think that at some point in his backstory, like he ended up on the bad side of like someone farther up the hierarchy that he had to like he had to sort of go into unofficial exile, and even in unofficial exile, he still exerts like massive ability, like if not in influence, then in sheer aptitude. And getting shit done. He's proven that up until this point.
And then, I guess before pizza, to get to pizza.
Yes, to get to pizza.
We have to have Shinohara. He is frazzled. He's greasy. He's been working all night. He knows from the factory experience that they can't get into this disc. They don't know what's on the install disc for the OS. Mm-hmm. And they have to use it. They've been using it anyway. So actually, whether or not it is an intentional bug or an accident, no one knows.
Yeah.
And he's also geolocated. Like, the labors going crazy are all in these three areas, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But before he can keep going, Godo's like, okay, take a break right
take
now.
A break.
I'm ordering you.
Yeah. And it's like, no, I want to get this. Like, no, I don't care. Take a break. And it's like, he just goes off.
So, they hop on a scooter and they go eat one of the most beautifully rendered pizzas I've ever seen in anime.
And we learn something. We learn something very important. We learn something very important about Noah and Alphonse. We learn that Alphonse is not the first Alphonse.
Really?
The Pat Labor is Alphonse the Third. Alphonse the Third. And it's like she looks out and she sees this person walking their dog. It's like, oh wow, that looks like Alphonse. And I was like, what? And I'm just like, yeah, the Alphonse the First. And it's like, so Alphonse is the Second? Like, no, Alphonse the Second was my cat. And it turns out that all this time Noah named her Pat Labor after her pet. It's her pet name. So really it's like cute. And that's it's really, really cute.
And it actually comes right before she just like unloads to him.
Yeah.
I mean, okay. First of all, I guess we all listen to the dub, but I'm curious with your Canadian. What did they call the pizza they got?
Something foreign pizza specifically. It's like
mine was Deluxe Japanese Ethnic Pizza.
Yes, that was it. Yes, okay. Yes.
Yeah.
But yeah, it looked beautiful. They set it down. And then before they even start eating, Izumi just kind of like starts unloading about how scared she is that her Alphonse could go berserk.
She's
terrified of that. And she's like, tell me it's not going to happen. Tell me my Alphonse won't go. And she starts to cry. And, he's actually pretty good at comforting her, which again, I noticed like, oh, he's matured a little bit. He's not being a jerk here, where he was a jerk a lot in the series. I mean, he's kind of a jerk by the end of the scene, but anyway, she says like, can we install the old OS? Like, I can't imagine this happening. And I liked how he's like, we can't install the old OS because we'd have to file the paperwork, which felt like, oh, okay. He's learning from Godo a little bit.
Yeah.
But he's like, we'll try to figure this out. It's going to be okay. And then I think it's the dog conversation, I think, kind of comes up. Okay.
Then we learn that the dog is named after her pet, and that's why she is so endeared to this Pat Labor, not just because she is a futurist and because she loves machines. It's because she has now formed an emotional attachment to her Alfie. Yeah.
And I'm trying to remember, what is the realization that Shinohara has in that moment that leads him to take her fucking scooter and run?
They see a dog outside, which I think is why she brings this up. Right. And the dog, I don't know, it like looks at something outside and it's like, oh, we must hear something. It's the wind.
That's right.
They can hear things, but, you know, they can't hear.
Yes.
And that's what Asuma's like, oh, of course.
It's like the Pat Labor sensors. They're sensing something that we as humans cannot hear. And just like, he's like, then he books it. Yeah.
Yeah. He takes the scooter that they rode to the pizza place on and just leaves on his own, which is just the most Asuma. This is,
he really is.
It's so great. She's just like, you idiot. You can't just leave me here. You jerk. I hate you.
This guy's such a piece of shit.
Yeah. Just when here you think he's actually being nicer than he usually ever has, and it's like, oh, he's, you know, he's grown a little bit. Their relationship's evolving. Nope. It's like
nope, time for me to hyper focus on something else.
and also make sure you do these things for me back at base. And she's like, the base, how am I gonna get there?
And I was like, I don't know.
But who's the guy he goes to visit?
That is I think it's like a family friend of his through Shinohara Heavy Industries.
Okay.
Who is like,
looks like the same guy who old man Sakaki was talking to earlier.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Cause I couldn't quite tell. And I was like, this is not his dad. The way they're talking, this cannot be his dad. We've just said,
no, his dad is off. He's off doing some other stuff. And this, this family friend, this person who is also part of Shinohara Heavy Industries is entertaining family. He's entertaining, I think, his son-in-law, his daughter, and their young child. Yeah.
Okay.
His grandchild. Yeah. His grandkids. Yeah. Yeah.
And I really like this sequence. This really does feel like, you mentioned it earlier, but this really feels like Asuma learning from Godo. Very specifically, because he does a lot of Godo things in this scene.
Yeah.
Because he's talking to this guy and he's prying him for more information on what's going on with this HOS installation. And he's just chilling in a room with him talking. And he ends up deciding to manipulate him down a emotional path because he sees these illustrations that the grandson has done of Pat Labor's.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he's a little kid. He loves them the way like little kids love construction equipment and trucks and stuff. Mm-hmm. And in prying for more information from him, the path he goes is like, listen, we really need to be sure here because like, I don't want your grandkid growing up thinking that Pat Labors can go crazy and like hurt people. Mm-hmm. Like it's really good. It's cunning.
Yeah.
He specifically cites like what frequency would it take in order to like make a labor go berserk, and I was like, I figure that this was something that Hoba implemented, and that you leapt at acquiring Hoba because you thought that, you know, with Haas you would have like this like competitive edge in the market, but now that he's presumably dead and Haas has been rolled out to all these different places and they're all in. Haas can be traced all the way back to Shinohara Heavy Industries, that if it comes to light that there's something wrong with Haas and somebody knew about it, whether it was not, it was like the higher ups or anything like that, and they're just gone, then they're going to be liable for it. So that's why his dad is like running around trying to like do whatever the hell he can to like fix this shit, but he can't really fix this shit. So, yeah.
So yeah, after he succeeds at manipulating this man, we're back at headquarters where Asuma is getting punished.
Yeah,
which is very very good to wrap on all this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's great because it's one of those like, okay, you really messed up here. You left without asking. You dropped somebody else off and didn't even take them back home. You
rode on a scooter. Well, a scooter with two people, and you also drove drunk.
And you drove drunk.
Like, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you revealed information you were supposed to. So you're going to get punished.
Yeah.
Also, this did help because now they know there's a problem and they're going to put an update to all the OSs to kind of revert them and fix them and to revert them to the old EOS, but we're going to call it an upgrade. So that gets everyone to do it without anyone thinking there's something bad going on. And we fixed it. The problem solved. Good job. But also you're punished.
Yeah. And then it's the back and forth with the fish-eyed lens and stuff.
Oh,
and
my God. Yes.
It's so hilarious. And it's just like, zooming in on like these police buttons, these police like star buttons or whatever. It's like, it's very funny.
Cause he shouts at Asuma, "This is not the place to solve family feuds."
Yeah. And I'm just like, no, it's like, this is, I knew that this was right and I needed to do this.
Well, see, I feel like there's a bit of a like, I mean, if I get that, you know, for the two for the price of one. But
right,
that's,
exactly. It's like, I was right, though, wasn't I?
Yeah,
I was right.
He's like, he's kind of right to call him out that he might be a little biased here.
Yeah.
Maybe in a good way, but like, it's funny. The whole conversation and this guy, I guess we don't see this man that often, but he's technically the lead of the whole Pat Labor division.
Mm-hmm.
So he's kind of Godo's boss, but we see him a little bit more in this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, then we have a nice little rooftop debrief with Godo and Izuma. An exciting friend returns from the States, Shigeo, the engineer,
yeah,
has been stateside working on setting up the new Pat Labor divisions over there. Mm-hmm. And then we get another really fucking funny reveal, a classic Godo reveal, which is that Shigeo never updated the Pat Labors with HOS because he had a bad feeling about it. And again,
also it'd be annoying. There was a certain, to me, was like, I feel like IT systems people have got to feel so represented here because like order from down on high, you got to do this, install us and all the stuff, the new AI tech, the new, like, you know,
yeah,
whatever. And it's like, yeah, sure, boss. It's all installed. You know, thumbs up.
If they can't tell the difference, does it matter? No, it doesn't.
Right. And so, and Godo knew and still said that that all of the Pat Labors had been updated with HOS just to make the fire underneath Izuma even hotter when he was trying to get him to investigate this stuff.
Also, he ratted him out about the, like, riding a scooter drunk because Noah ratted out to him.
Oh my God.
And he's like, oh, yeah, I totally, you know, Noah told me and I totally told them because... now that you're not,
now you got to take a, now you can take a break. You can take a break.
You know, wink, wink. If you're on a break, who knows what you could get up to?
Yeah.
There's an incredible frame of him. Cause Shigeo was just back from the States. He's wearing this silk button down dragon t-shirt.
Yes.
He has these red sunglasses on and he's sitting on a desk, regaling everybody with the United States stories, but he's doing the literal fuckboy face in this frame. He's like,
I'm also curious if your dub, like, he starts talking in a kind of like bad Brooklyn accent.
Oh my God.
Or something. Oh, like, he's a big New Yorker. And because I thought specifically he was helping Kanuka set up like hers in New York City. So I thought that's why he was doing that. Like, oh yeah, become a big American now going to New York City.
Yeah.
We're back to the detectives because they find the very first home
that Hoba ever lived in. Yeah.
And they think this is going to be like, you know, where they crack this puzzle, but it's just empty.
Mm-hmm.
Just like all the other ones. What is his point? And I think you get this little conversation. They start talking. Our detective talks about, I'm trying to remember how they bring this up, about like Pat Labors or the Pat Labor team, because he's like telling his assistant, like, they're not like everyday cops. They're more like superheroes.
Yeah.
And it was like, that was goofy as shit.
Yes.
That line and that delivery was one of the sillier things I've seen on this entire series.
Mm-hmm.
It passed by without a problem, but I was just like, I don't know. I don't know if I call them superheroes.
This is like, no, no.
In one of his apartments that they do find carved on the wall, he bowed the heavens also and came down, and darkness was under his feet. Once again, just sort of, I don't know, you know, I didn't even bother to look up to see if this is scripture.
Yeah.
Like Godo said it was like a psalm or something like that. And I was like, I didn't look it up either. It was like, I'll probably look it up after this, like after this recording. I'm just like, oh, this is what I meant. It's like, oh, okay.
Sounds good enough to me. I mean,
yeah.
But that is important because that is combined with the fact that Kanuka, their lady in the States for the team, I guess is also covers the like Pat Labor Division of Boston, because she looked into MIT for them and finds out that he was nicknamed Jehovah. Or more specifically, or it's like the way it's technically pronounced is Yehovah, but the Jehovah thing, like they decide to like explain
that it was just mistranslated, and Jehovah became like the sort of like popularization of it. And then when Hoba learned about that, he thought that was really funny. He like really loved that. Really weird guy. Really, really weird guy is like it's and then I think the detective and Goda have this sort of like back and forth, sort of like existential philosophical conversation about like their own sort of respective takes on where Hoba might be coming from in terms of his motivations for doing what he's doing. My sort of takeaway from that is that like I think it's just like about industrialization. It's about like the old being swept away so indiscriminately and so dispassionately that it's just like without any sense of history whatsoever. It's like maybe we should just accelerate that. There's like so much that we make industrialization so fast that it just unmakes itself while it's trying to make itself at the same time. It's like that was at least my takeaway from it.
I think and we'll get closer to this bit as the plot goes along. I think it's like, for me, it just kind of helped. I was like, what is this guy's motivation? And I was like, well, what is his name? It's Jehovah. Yeah. What does he call this thing that they're building? Babel, the tower that, you know, humans built when they're getting above their station.
They're getting too big for their britches. Pat Labor's are a little too big for their britches.
and then what happens, you know, with the Tower of Babel story, are all the Labors are going to become unable to interface, communicate with humans, not under their control anymore.
Yeah.
Chaos ensues. I mean, it's foreshadowed here actually pretty heavily, but they're going back and forth in like Tower of Babel, Babylon Project. What's his plan? Mm-hmm. He wouldn't have killed himself if he didn't know it would succeed.
Yes.
Which is about like one of the things they kind of like, they do realize that that's got to be true. While this is happening, or I guess around this time, Asuma is like, he's taken that geolocating of the berserking Labors. Mm-hmm. And he's started to look into more. It's about skyscrapers. They seem to always be around these skyscrapers connected to his realization with the dogs and the sounds they don't hear. He's like, oh, these skyscrapers make a frequency when the wind blows through them at a certain like speed, and that's what's triggering them. Or this tunnel, it's about air currents and whistles and stuff.
Yeah.
But this is all it seems to be. It's just going to, you know, wind here. Why would he do this? What's it matter? And then he's like, oh, of course, we never ran the simulation with the arc at the center. And they run the simulation like, oh my God, resonance would cause high enough amount of wind to reflect from these skyscrapers around Tokyo to the arc and back. They would essentially, you know, this is a true thing. If you look into wave resonance, this is a thing that can happen, is they reinforce each other. And this would cause essentially every Labor in the greater Tokyo area to go berserk.
Yes.
And to be perfectly clear, because we haven't mentioned the arc in a while, the arc is a massive factory research platform floating in the middle of Tokyo Bay. It's like the size of several city blocks taped together, and it's just out in Tokyo Bay, and they're building Labors out there.
Kind of the headquarters of the Babylon Project.
The centerpiece of the Babylon Project,
And we didn't really mention the brief bit of it we saw at the beginning. They're walking through it, and it is designed, like, it's labor-sized. It's designed for Labors to walk around in. It is crawling with construction Labors. They are everywhere.
Yeah.
And conveyor belts and all this stuff. So it's a big deal.
It reminded me a little bit of, and I know this might be a reach, but like seeing the inside of the arc and seeing all these different sort of like Labors milling about, it reminded me of the inside of the Citadel from Half-Life 2, when you're just like going through it and you're seeing all these like different like sort of like combined synths going around, and it's like you see all these inner workings. It's not as menacing as the Citadel, but like it sort of reminded me of that level of scale of industrialization of like all these different moving parts. I thought that was cool.
I got a bit of Armored Core 6 vibes in the it's giant robot scale. Like it's a huge building for giant robots. It's still a huge building. Like it's a big thing. And so the thing they find out with the simulation is this big resonance cascade. Oh, speaking of
it. Yeah.
will happen if winds reach 40 miles per hour.
Well, that's not going to happen.
Well, that's not going to happen. Oh, no, I just looked at the newspaper and a typhoon is headed this way.
You're fucked.
And so I don't know. Is this the point where they connect this dot? But this is this explains the timing of Ehoba's suicide. As Ehoba saw the news forecast, the weather forecast, and knew that the wind was coming that would do the thing that he wanted to do. So he's like, I'm out.
Yeah.
Seemingly. I mean, again,
my work is done.
His body was never recovered.
True. That's true.
I was definitely thinking about that this whole time. We get I really like this next scene though, because speaking of how Gota meshes with authority and the leadership, we are at what I think is the Tokyo like city council or like the cabinet, the Tokyo mayor's cabinet or something. And I know he just lays it out. He's like, okay, this is the problem. Once the winds reach this height, at this typhoon hits, every labor in the greater Tokyo area is going to go nuts. Mm-hmm. So you have, what are his four options he gives them?
I think one of them is dismantle every single labor within, like,
that is, yes.
You can't do that.
Because I try to think, I'm not sure if he says dismantle the Ark, dismantle every labor, or every one of these skyscrapers.
Yes.
Yeah. Those.
Or stop the typhoon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You can't do that. And it's like, you got to do at least like one of these. Like,
you have to do one of these four.
Yeah.
Or you're going to lose Tokyo.
Yeah. And I think there's one point that like push back and he's just like, it doesn't matter if you push back. It's like, this is the situation, what it is. See, this is why Gota was such a hard ass at the beginning with Azuma, because he knew this was going to happen. And you have to have everything buttoned up before you go in. Like, this is what has to happen. Because as much as he might be a hard ass, there is an even harder ass beyond all of this. Yeah. Like, he knows. Like, yeah.
They listen to this and they're like, okay, here's what we'll do. We'll deactivate them all. We'll make an order out there. This is 2 days before the typhoon's going to hit. We'll have every labor deactivated for like the next 72 hours. And it'll be fine. It'll be fine. No worries. Also, we've sent out that update, so everything should be okay because everything's got the old OS installed. And they're like, it is very likely that this computer genius knows you might try to do that. He has been ahead of us every step of the way. So just reinstalling the OS, like, that's not going to be enough. In fact, we're pretty sure that I can't remember. This is where they figure out. Oh, no, it's not. Okay. They find out something more about the virus in a little bit. But right now, they're just making the assumption that that OS reinstall was probably not good enough. And we should not trust that.
Yeah.
And at this point, they're like, all right, well, let's go blow up the Ark.
Well, so I'm trying to remember, is it Gota who just kind of says, but you know, if it was an act of God.
Yes.
Which, you know,
then you can't really fault anybody. You can't fault anybody for it, like, falling apart, you know?
So, yeah.
I didn't connect the dots to this exactly what he was saying. Because, you know, I sometimes I'm dumb. I'm like Noah or Asuman. I was like, I don't get it. What's the plan here?
Yeah.
Where he starts saying that, other than me going like, oh, act of God, another Christian reference. But it's funny because that's like also an insurance reference. Like, if something's destroyed in a big storm, that's an act of God. No one could have prevented that. No one could have known.
Right.
And so their plan is literally to use the hurricane as cover for the typhoon. Mm-hmm. So they're like, the tacit agreement from the city council is basically like, look, we will disavow this if your investigations into the virus OS turns out that it is not what you're saying it is. It's not some big criminal conspiracy. If it is, you know, then we'll investigate that and point it out and you guys will be right. But if you're wrong, we will just be like, I guess the hurricane destroyed the Ark. Oh, well. And then one has to know.
Yep.
This sequence rocks, the Ark raid sequence. Everything about it so they get up the two Pat Labors and
montage,
they patrol car.
Montage.
They get ready, that they ship out.
They shoot a car with a sniper and it like explodes into the sky.
Oh my god, it's so fucking cool. Is this rocks, when? Yeah. Is this when? When our friend from New York flies back into town.
Oh, yeah.
Like the, and this is the first time that she's been introduced in the entire movie. She's been referenced before, mm-hmm. but this is the first time we've actually seen her. And so, like, it's so weird, like, having watched this the first time and not knowing who this character was, like, oh, she seems pretty cool. But now watching it as a Pat Labor fan, I'm like, oh, yes. Shit. I'm just like, are you here for work or are you here for pleasure? It's like, neither. Combat. I'm like, yes. Let's go.
No. I'm like, don't tell that to security. They're not going to let you in the country.
You can't tell it to security, but she don't give a fuck.
What an incredible scene. Yeah, I forgot about that already.
Oh, my God. It was a different time. Combat. It was a different time.
Like, dude. So Kanuka, who's like the hyper-competent pilot from the OVA, is back. She's going to be driving one of the mechs. She's going to be driving a Zero, right? The plan is to get her into the base and have her drive Model Zero.
I feel like that's not the plan. I feel like when she says she's going to do that, they're like, no, don't do it. She's like, I will take the risk. No. I thought she was just there to shoot her gun at robots.
She's just there to shoot her gun at robots. She doesn't care.
I mean, she has a little Jeep, I guess, but yeah. You know.
Yeah, so they load up onto some pontoons and they ship out to the Ark in the bay. This scene is so cool just because, like, you see this massive, ominous superstructure just, like, looming in the stormy sky, and they're just on these choppy waves on their way out to it.
Which I feel like I don't know how I didn't make the connection that it's like, oh, it's the Great Flood. We're in a big storm. We're at the Ark. Like, it's bad.
I know writers who use subtext and they're all cowards.
Yes, exactly.
So, yeah, they spent the day, like, they had 2 days. They spent, like, a day and a half practically preparing, and this is, like, the night where the winds are getting up to that 40 miles an hour. It's like, okay, we're going to destroy it in one night. And they have a way. They know what they're doing going in, which is get to the control room, and you can literally, like, drop the floors of this. It's like a layer cake. Even more specifically, it's like a crepe cake. It's like all these very thin layers stacked on top of each other. And apparently for fire prevention or fire safety, you could just eject the floors and let them fall. And that would destroy this. It would destroy the wind, how it would flow through it.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember. It's something. Maybe I'm miscombining this and the plates of the city of Midgar. But I think it's something like they have a symmetrical drop system. That if there's a fire in one segment, they can drop it out, but then they'll also drop out a mirrored segment from it so that the entire platform doesn't go off balance. So like, well, we'll just drop all the platforms.
God.
So yeah, they're going to completely fuck this thing up, but they're a little worried because it is home to many, many labors in development and completed labors, and the wind is starting to blow, and they are worried that they're going to go berserk. So, and they do. They end up having to fight off a whole bunch of berserk drones and labors, and
those drones were so cool. They were
the little red guys.
Cool. Yeah, the little red guys. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That I guess at first that's the like the normal security that just activates because someone has broken in.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get to the control room, they activate the emergency alarm that deactivates the security they expected to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But they notice something on the computer screen, and that is that someone else is here. It's supposed to be entirely evacuated because of the typhoon, but not just anyone is here. Hoba is here. In the secondary control room on the very top of the structure. So they send Izumi to go check it out because, you know, could be unsafe. Take your labor, figure out what's going on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this
we need you, not Oda, to go there because Oda's a pothead. We need somebody who can actually make like delicate on the job decisions, and that is not Oda. Oda is the person that you throw at something. If you, everything is a nail, then he's the hammer. He's the hammer who just hits something. Yeah, perfect hammer. Yeah.
Is this the shot where we have Noah reloading the revolver?
No. Okay, we're going to get to that.
Okay.
We're going to get to that.
Yeah.
This is where MIT, like back at base, the rest of the team is like, okay, MIT has finished cracking Haas. Haas is cracked. Confirmed, definitely illegal virus in here. It's actually worse than we thought. Any computer that this comes into contact to, not just labors, will be infected by it, including the Ark's main computer. And that's what leads to all the labors getting infected on the base, even though like, you know, the main computer starts fighting with them. They're like, okay, we have to figure out how to like start ejecting platforms before it can takes total control.
And he was ahead of us the whole time.
Yeah.
He was ahead of us the whole time.
And I think this is where, because it's now starting to get dire with all the labors going full zombie, that Kanuka gets into Type Zero. And she's like, don't worry, I have a fresh install. And it's like, where? What? And she's like, I'm going for broke. We have to make tough decisions. I'll take the risk.
I think you just want to drive the mech.
Yeah.
I think you just want to drive the cool mech.
You put on like a cool cyber helmet when you get into this new one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You become more inside the machine. A part of the machine. And this is where Izumi, like, hand and fist and gun, fights her way through the labor. And I said zombie because at this point they really start getting the like infected labors a zombie vibe. Like the way they walk, it's like they're kind of shuffling a little bit. They lurch around somewhat. I think we're in dark, stormy weather. It's very horror vibes here. It's cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But she's on the big elevator. And I wrote this out in all caps. They have to get out of their labors to reload their guns.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Yeah.
That's right.
That's wild.
It was, like, too perfect for this. It was like, of course they do.
Yes.
Of course they do.
Yeah.
And it's such a beautiful scene, too. Like, just the scale of it is gorgeous. Yeah, she's just blasting with the revolver, walking backwards. Elevator door closes. It starts going up. And the mech just takes a knee and just like she's carrying a single shell at a time into the chamber.
Yeah.
Because, it's like, not even like a handy, like it's got all six of them in it. You just plug that in and then you
can. No, it's not like that. No.
One at a time.
They haven't made that yet.
It was so funny to me. I was like this like heated action section. I was like, no. Is that what she's doing? Oh, of course.
I really like it.
It was so funny.
But yeah, you get this really next moody scene where she makes it to the top of the platform, has to go up the stairs to the top control room on the Ark, and finds it full of birds.
Just birds. Alfred Hitchcock's birds.
It's really
birds.
Creepy.
I'd already been flown through for a loop by the gun reloading thing, and then this hit me, and I'm just like, okay, all right, just take me for a ride. This movie rocks.
Yeah.
There's birds with red eyes. They're all a bunch of different species, too.
Yeah.
But of course, it does make you think about those bird cages.
And then it's Homa's personal pet bird who has like a 666 like name tag whatever on its foot, and it's just like blah. And I'm just like Jesus Christ.
Yeah. So the implication there, I believe, is that that's his ID tag, and that's what was giving the signal of Homa being in the building. It was he had put his ID tag on his bird. So Homa is in fact probably dead or long gone.
Yes. But good to them to like do that foreshadowing thing with the body was never recovered. It got me. I was sure he was going to be in here and give his villain monologue, but that's not what this is about. I think it's trying to be something more here, which the final confrontation to me is what this is about, but we'll get there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the computer systems are all going haywire. Where Babel is just spamming on the screens.
Now we're at that. It's dire. Oda is just hand-to-hand combat, fighting zombie labors.
Yeah.
It rocks. Like, in the animation in this scene, when he's just, like, reaching in and just pulling out handfuls of components is incredible. He does a fucking pro wrestling backbreaker.
Wait, that's
Zero does that. No, you're right. Yeah, that's the yes.
He does it. He just rips an arm off of one of these things and starts bashing them with it.
It's so cathartic. It's so cathartic after being like so withheld for most of the OVA and even some of the movie too. Is like just to be like, yeah, now I can finally just
it rocks.
Just kick the shit out of all these robots with my big robot.
Yeah, it rules. I mean, this is it's a really good. Big conclusion scene because we're cutting back from a lot of things. All these plots are interesting to follow. It never feels like we're losing the pace of it. Like even the breathing room is nice.
Mm-hmm.
And but then we get this, and it's just like it's balls to the wall. It is truly zombie like chaos.
This is why you came to the movies.
Yeah,
this is why you came to the cat labor movie.
Then they Oshi us with it because you see a labor do the coolest, most violent stuff you have ever seen a labor do.
Yes,
and then in that moment, the eye blinks red, the central eye lights up, and it's like, oh, this thing that you thought was really, really, really cool because of how violent it was is now a problem because it has lost control. So it's like,
okay, it introduces itself by doing a Bane style back break. I guess that's where I came at. It's like, oh, there's breaking Batman's back. But yeah, it's a pro wrestling move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It rules. She's also, it's like the main weapon of this, the Type Zero, is that its arms are like claws, like the a bunch of dagger points. And when they're all together, the whole hand is like one giant dagger. And then it like extends out to twice its length, lightning fast. And she's just like shoving it to things' faces. And also this thing gives off vampire vibes. Like if the other things
are such an evil looking mech. It's zombies. Like Noah was right. She totally clocked that this thing was so fucking evil.
This thing looks like a vampire or something. It's something a little in if the other Pat Labors are trying to look somewhat human. Mm-hmm. This thing looks a little inhuman. Like especially the claw hands, but also the head. And then as you said, as it's starting to just it's so badass. Look how much it's tearing them apart with its bare hands, and then its eyes turn red. And it cuts to Oda, who's like, here's someone talking with him on the phone, and they're like, we're desperate, we need you, gotta get back here. And he's just going like, oh no.
Yeah.
Like he's watching her transform in front of him, basically.
Mm. Yeah, how generally unyielding the philosophy within the show is that any weapon you create will be used against you. It's wonderful.
Yes.
And then we do have a wonderful shot of while Noah is struggling to, she's struggling with like, this movie has a great self-destruct mechanism. Like,
yes,
I think it's up there with Alien in terms of good self-destruct mechanisms where it's like a weird panel in the ground and it has a bunch of weird shit you got to do to make it work.
Uh-huh.
So she's struggling with one of those. Then we get.
And she's told to do that. Like they identify, okay, it's been hacked. So we're not going to be able to eject everything, all the floors by computer. We have to do it with the like physical backup that is like this one point at the top, which will release all of them when it's just mechanically. So, and it just turns out, Noah, you're right above it. So just go down there and you got to do this right now.
So she's working on that. And then we have this great shot of the Type Zero coming into the room, holding the head of the one of the other SV2 Pat Labor units in its hand, chilling stuff.
But those clawed hands, it was very that episode of Evangelion where the other kid is in a unit and it becomes
over. when Toji's inside of like when it's inside of the I think it's the Ava unit 5 or something like
four
that.
Four or five. Like, and the way it's like walking and kind of just slowly stomping forward, its arms are limp, but this one's holding a head and it's just like shoving itself into the control room where they've kind of like taken shelter. It's a bad scene.
Bad vibes. Not a good time.
But then as the station is collapsing, this is just some of the most incredible like animated destruction I've ever seen. It's like up there with like the part where they pull the Akira sphere up out of the ground.
Yes.
I also think of some like kind of the big conclusions to some of the Ghibli movies where it's just like everything on screen is animating. Like this must have taken forever.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, it is like you said earlier, is like, this is a world designed for giants. So then when you see it collapsing, just the scale of it is so unbelievable. It's just like these panels, like the sides of football fields, just free falling into the ocean, and like the size of swells, like the all this mass falling into the ocean combined with the already like choppy waves. It's like, it makes me like feel seasick looking at it. It's really incredible. But Noah has gotten back inside of her mech and she's like sliding down the
side
was
of one
the
of the
tower,
sickest
trying
shots.
To slow down.
Mm-hmm. Really incredible. Like a human might. It just looks so cool and with a Pat Labor. But we're not finished yet.
No.
Because this time it's daybreak. Now they're like starting to climb out of the rubble. because this thing, I was tricked for a sec. I thought it just fell into the water, but it's got like a huge platform it's on. So it's just all the rubble's just kind of sitting there in a heap. Mm-hmm. All of our heroes survived. You know, don't think too hard about it. It's the, it would be kind of morbid if they didn't. They're all alive. And specifically, Noah is still in her functioning Pat labor. It's dinged up quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, hers is not the only labor still functioning, because Zombie Kanuka is also rises from the grave.
Zombie Zero.
And then we get a no-holds knockout drag-em to the death duel between these two. And it also rules.
It's really good.
Yeah.
Because there's like the added wrinkle that they're like, you can't kill Kanuka. She's still in there.
Yes. So yeah.
Noah's kind of like holding her, pulling her punches a little bit and trying to figure out, how can I deactivate this thing that has knives for hands without getting myself, without hurting?
With these fucking, what is it? Freddy Krueger like arm extensions or whatever. Yeah, just like, how do I beat this thing?
Again, this show just has like this like near constant reverence for human life. Mm-hmm. Which is so, it's so thorough, it's so ingrained in this thing, where it's like you're setting up for the thing that is supposed to be the climactic duel. You have Noah ready, aim her pistol at the target, and instead of getting an action scene, the action scene you expected, mm-hmm. you get the radio transmission like, no, our friend's still in there. You got to find a way to do this less. You got to find a way to do this smarter, not just the most direct violent way that you can do it.
Oh, and at a point, Kanuka wakes up and is even like, just kill me. You won't be able to stop this thing, you know, with your older unit. This thing's a killing machine. It's unstoppable.
Mm-hmm.
But she's able.
I love that she, go ahead.
You know, she's like, no, I'm definitely not going to do that. How can I stop this thing? Well, it does have a, like, the OS, I don't know, memory banks are in this part behind the neck. So maybe you can attack that.
And I, for like a character thing for Noah, I really, really like that she has to sacrifice her mech to do it. Like,
exactly.
Yeah.
Like, and she established in this movie specifically just how much it means to her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But in this situation, she is willing to essentially sacrifice Alphonse, because it becomes like a, you know, they're throwing each other around, mm-hmm. and eventually Noah almost gets pulled over the side. But she's able to like grab the Type Zero.
It's even more slightly premeditated than that, because as Type Zero is rushing her, she deploys the winch from hers and tangles it around Type Zero, knowing that they're both going to tumble over. Then they'll be tangled together, and that'll give her the opportunity to do what she needs to do.
Which is to get in a position where she can climb out of her Alphonse with a shotgun, a human shotgun, and just walk up to the back of this thing, open up the little hatch, and start shooting the brains with a shotgun.
This is going to feel like kind of a reach, is like, but with the whole winch like wrapping around like Type Zeros, like it kind of reminds me of Tim Burton's Batman. Sort of at the end, where like at the end, where like Batman's about to like fall, is like he's hanging from the side of the cliff, and he uses his grappling hook in order to like wrap around the Joker's leg right when he's like hanging onto the helicopter. You know, like you know what I mean?
It was just strategy.
Same strategy. Yeah.
But yeah, she just fucking unloads into the ram on this thing, and it works. And we just, that movie ends with just a very nice, peaceful sequence of the sun is up now, mm-hmm. and they're sort of surveying the damage, and she just takes off her helmet, climbs out of the mech. It's really good.
We did it. I did it. It's nice. But it's very quick ending. It's like, okay, it's done. We're done.
Yeah.
And then we get the reveal, I think, that Nagumo is totally, not Nagumo, Kanuka is completely okay.
Yes.
Yes. Yay.
Thankfully. Yay.
Everyone's okay. They saved the day.
So that's the first Pat Labor movie. And God, what a movie.
So good. It's so, so good. And then it's just like, it's we start here. Like, this is a great movie. But then you then go to Pat Labor 2. And I am so excited to see the quantum leap of expectation of both expectation and like the bar being raised in all sort of respects, because that is like Oshii really going in on his Oshii bullshit, like full on. Like, it's that's the movie that that directly led to the production of Ghost in the Shell. And you can totally tell. I can't wait.
It was the first thing I'd heard of with this series. I just heard that, like, oh yeah, there's this mecha anime movie. It's the second in the series, and it's all it's like a political thriller. It's not what you expect from an anime robot movie. And just knowing that that one receives praise outside of even just like anime quarters, combined with now this knowledge I have of this series. And honestly, the main thing I'm like, okay, is it going to still feel pat labor and the like jokiness and the cast of characters? And I, if it doesn't, I'm not like heartbroken, but I was like, this one had quite a lot of that. Like, this one still made me laugh a lot when it was supposed to make me laugh. Like, because they had well-written jokes and stuff. I doubt that what I know about the second one is going to be quite as much of a fun experience. And
it will go deeper in on a character that has been around since the beginning of the OVA, since the beginning of the series, that we conspicuously do not know a lot about. A major character that we conspicuously do not know a lot about.
Can't wait.
Yes. Yeah.
That's so exciting. This movie, it rocks.
Today is that it fucking rocks.
Yeah, I don't have a labor. Hey, here's the labor point for today. Take the day off.
It's really important to take the day off take time off.
Yes.
Here's the thing. If you're one of those like lucky people that has that supposedly unlimited time off.
Yeah.
Just like take a day. Just use it. Just take a day off in the middle of the week. Right. You know, because they don't think you will, but you can.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's tough for you.
Take a Friday off. Take a Monday off. Have a little 3-day weekend for yourself.
Summer Fridays don't just have to be summer.
They don't have to be. Yeah,
sometimes summer winter just, Fridays.
Sometimes, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Why don't you go to the grocery store at 2 p.m.?
Yeah. Why don't you catch a matinee?
Yeah. Go see Predator Badlands, which I do need to see.
Ooh. I haven't seen that yet either. I've been too busy. I haven't been to see that. I've been slacking on the movie front. I know that I went to go see One Battle After Another twice. I went to go see that two times. I went to see that once on my own and once with a friend. And I'm just like, yeah, this movie fucking rocks. I love this movie. It's very, very good. It might be a front runner for one of my favorites of the year. Yeah, absolutely.
Hell yeah.
I think we can all recommend that one to Arnold.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It was like, if you're into Andor, then yeah, you definitely should watch this as well too, because it's got its own little I have friends everywhere sort of like password thing that just evolves into an on-running joke for the entire movie. Yeah, it's fucking awesome.
All right, so just a little, I guess, housekeeping. Is that what the podcast called this?
Yes.
So we're going to go on hiatus after this episode, basically, just for a little time. It's the holidays. There's work stuff that annoyingly happens this time of year. So just to make sure we're still consistent when we come back, we're going to take a little break till mid-January. You know, we'll see what exactly that ends up being, but we will, within our power, try to make another bonus episode happen. And we've thought about this, and we're going to have a little discussion about the whole season of the OVA. We're still going to do that, but we want to talk about a movie that we brought up. I think maybe in one of our video segments. So check out those. Subscribe to rogue.site. But we're going to talk about Shin Godzilla.
Oh yeah,
because there is no movie we could all think of that's more pat labor coded, at least in terms of bureaucracy, and that's effects on government responses to large things, I guess, like labor, or in this case, a large monster.
And the first time I saw Pat Labor, the movie, my very first thought was like, holy shit, I think Shin Godzilla must have been influenced by this really strongly.
It
just
must
from
have
the
been.
Setup of like, you have a mysterious scientist who leaves the world with an ethical, technological quandary, and then sees how they'd react to it. But he's already gone. right?
Incredible. Like, yeah. I didn't even, what yeah. a poll. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So we're definitely going to have a fun time talking about that one, and it'll be a bonus episode you can only listen to if you subscribe to Rogue.site. Look out for that one in the next couple of weeks here. We'll get it out before holiday travel. Hopefully you have it. We appreciate you all subscribing. We'll have a little video bonus here at the end. And for Pat's Labor, I am Clayton.
I'm Tucson Egan.
And I'm Pat.
Labor.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.